Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. I want to welcome back our listeners to this week's episode of the Evolving to Exceptional podcast. We have Sharon Winfield with us here today. She is the Chief Human Resources Officer at the YWCA of Metropolitan St. Louis. She has many years of experience and just a tremendous amount of wisdom to share with us based on that experience, and will bring to us a unique perspective of what it's like to be in the HR space in a non-for-profit, in an organization that maybe doesn't have the same resources or even the same appeal that maybe some of the corporate for-profit businesses do. So Sharon, welcome to the podcast. I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself, tell our audience a little bit about who you are, your background, and why it is that you do what you do.
Thank you, Jessica, for inviting me. I am really honored to be able to participate in this podcast. The topic is dear to my heart. I am, again, Sharon Winfield, Chief Human Resource Officer for the Y. I've been with the Y 4.5 years. And coming to the Y, I came to the Y from corporate to nonprofit because of the mission of what we do, which is eliminating racism, me being an African-American female, and empowering women. So that was a mission that really drove home to me on why I chose to end the remaining part of my HR career. I've been in HR 30 years, and to say this is where I want to retire. What excites me is making a difference. From a human perspective, human resources deals with people. We can call it human resources. Some people call it, I consider them as assets, not liabilities to the organization. So what excites me really is the human aspect, the people aspect of the organization, that being the human resource aspect of why we run and how we run the organization. So I am so excited to be here. Besides that, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, and I'm a world traveler, so we'll talk a little bit more about even what I've seen from a world perspective, from a people perspective, from a human resource perspective. In my previous employers, I actually supported an international division, and from a human resources standpoint, international HR is very different countries than it is from the United States. Apples and oranges.
I could totally see that. Let's maybe dive into that a little bit, because I love, you and I talked about this before, the experience or the perspective you bring, having been in the HR space for your whole career, of what that transition has looked like over the years. What have you seen in terms of that, of the profession, as how it's evolved or how it's changed over the years? And feel free to bring in that global perspective too, of what do you see as you're looking at that, not just over the years, but then around the world as well.
Yes. And I'll talk about it pre-COVID, because this is what I did before COVID. When my previous HR, I supported not only our domestic St. Louis, Chicago, Dallas division, I also supported our London division, our China division, and our Mexico division. Three separate cultures. One organization internationally, but very differently. Even from a culture standpoint, when we would have meetings, you would need to know what the different cultures were, because you could have easily offended someone in that culture. For example, when you would go to Mexico, you would really do a lot of, how are you? And how are things going? And you do a lot of conversations and talking. And then I'm thinking, so when are you going to start this meeting? And that was the culture of our Mexico. Very warm, very welcoming, not as a state of urgency as we do in the United States. In the United States, our culture, we tend to want things like this. In our Mexico division, it was, and we had to learn this from a headquarters standpoint, that that's their culture, that sometimes things start at noon. And we get started at 7 o'clock in the morning and we're like, why are you still here sitting around at noon?
I can see that being such a culture shock almost of this is really different. This is a really different way of working. How did you navigate that?
We had to learn. We actually brought in coaches to teach us the various cultures because we were doing it wrong. And on one side, it was, okay, I think we're offending people, but they didn't necessarily say it. So we actually had to bring in someone to teach us the various cultures. We actually wind up opening up an office in India, which is another cultural difference. When I dealt with our China or Shanghai division, it was there was very little feedback because they saw us as you're the person in authority and we don't question that. So it was always a yes. And I'm thinking, no, no, I need you to tell me what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. It was very not look you so much in the eye. It was really based on a respect level and a position level. So very stark difference between our Shanghai division and our Mexican division and our corporate office, which is in St. Louis. So I really was honored to be able to experience the differences, even in our London, when I was recruiting, they're 5 hours difference from us. So I'm at home at 5 o'clock in the morning recruiting because they're 5 hours ahead and they've already gotten their day started. So it was really a great opportunity to learn the international aspect of human resources and the people that made up those specific divisions. But it taught our corporate office, you got some work to do because we think it'll evolve around us. But it really took for us to really learn we needed each one of those divisions to be a successful international company. And we had to learn that. We had to learn what do you do in India? What do you learn to do in London? What do you learn to do? What best practices work for us as an international company? So it was a great learning experience for me.
You know what I think is so interesting about the different cultures around the world? And oftentimes I think sometimes we can talk about it almost as if those cultures are voluntary or something that we choose into. Your example of Mexico and not getting started until later or things like that, as if that is a choice in how to work rather than truly an embedded set of ways of being. And so when we think about it, when I look at things like this through kind of the neuroscience lens and the human performance lens, that as we're growing, as we're having all these experiences and we're growing up in these environments, our neural pathways, our ways of being, our ways of existing and responding and interacting in the world get shaped by all of those cultural experiences. And so when an organization comes in, say from another country and says, this is how we do it, it's not just here, let me tell you how we do it. And you've got to conform because you're really trying to transform people's entire way of being and way of existing. And that's not an easy transformation. That's not just, let me set some new expectations and you will follow them. In order to create that change, you would have to do really significant rewiring of those neural pathways to create that change. And alternately, it sounds like you guys dive into the other option is to figure out how to make the cultures be able to work together, how to respect their ways of being and working and existing in order to make it successful in that culture. Because again, just changing it to meet the culture of another country or another location isn't going to make that organization successful in that space, right? Because they're in the culture that operates a certain way.
Yes. And that's so true when you say that. And it took a while. This didn't happen overnight. It took an adjustment for our executives to realize that. And it also took time for those international companies to realize it's a learning curve for us. So if we go into a meeting in Mexico and we sit down, you open our book and we're like, hey, let's get started. We didn't mean to offend you or anything. It took time for us to learn the whole process. So we were learning it together. But what I found was when they realized we were learning more about their culture, they were saying, we want to learn more about your culture. So it was reciprocal. Oh, we didn't realize that the American culture does this. And it was, we actually brought in, also we gave employees the option to do I can't remember the name of the company where you can learn the different languages. It's an organization software that you learn the different languages. And you got to choose the top three, which was Spanish, Mandarin, and you got to choose one more. And we paid for that for the services for our staff, because especially like our sales team, when you're dealing with someone in Shanghai, learn a little bit about the language as well. Not just the culture, but learn a little bit on the language as well.
Yeah, I think that's so powerful too, because language is how we understand one another. And so I think that really helps to bring that those alternative perspectives or that greater sense of understanding and awareness. Mm-hmm. And as I think about it too, so much of our communication, a big part of it is obviously verbal, but is also nonverbal. And if people have different mannerisms or ways of expressing, that's going to shift our interpretation of what they're saying or what they're meaning or intending to mean by what they say. And oftentimes, I think we underestimate how much our experiences are really shaping how we're interpreting a particular interaction or relationship or communication, and how our brains are really using all of that past data to inform that interaction and shape it. And so we really can't be objective in all those conversations. So the more we embrace that and can start to look at, okay, what is the other perspective? What is the other experience that I don't even have a context for to inform this conversation?
Correct. Absolutely. Correct.
So tell me a little bit more about what you've seen over the years of your career in terms of the people function and the role it's played maybe in organizations and how it's and what's happening with it right now. Is there a difference? Is it just more of the same? What are you seeing?
I've been in HR for 30 years and I've seen it go through a lot of changes. Some of them slow, depending on the organization. It used to be, when I was in it 30 years ago, we were seen as, we'll call you if we need HR. We'll call you. Oh, you need to hire. Go ahead and hire someone. We need you to help us term. But they didn't see HR as strategic. They didn't see us at the table with the CEO, the CFO, the COO. And that became a challenge for HR executives because we didn't have a voice. And it was, we're raising our hands and, hey, we're over here saying, but we can do this better from a people standpoint, from a human resources standpoint. But I felt no one was listening. So it took a lot of breaking down barriers, breaking down walls, taking no for an answer, and also proving that HR is a strategic partner in the organizations that they need to be in. And a lot of that has come through struggle, headache, but I'd like to position it and say now we're in a much better place. You see a lot more females at the head of HR now. 30 years ago, it was very few females. It was a lot of men at that organization or at that position. Now you're seeing a lot of human resource executives. I went to the SHRM conference this past June in Vegas, and it was from so many different levels of people that were attending, but they had a certain group of people called the C-suite, and it was executive vice president chiefs. There was a section that was really pertaining to what they need to do as an organization. And it was really important to hear it from that level and that perspective. Again, we are now at the table having to say, these are decisions that if you make this decision, this is going to strategically impact the organization. And I'll give you one example, COVID. Nobody expected COVID. No one was exempt from COVID, whether you were your mom and pop, whether you were a Fortune 5, a Fortune 1000, a nonprofit. No one expected COVID. No one anticipated COVID. And it really made all of us shift to say, where do we need to shift? Where do we must shift? And it changed our business strategy. So with that, I was really glad to see there were more chiefs at the table at that SHRM conference talking about the same thing, but also realizing we are making progress and that we will continue to show why we're needed in those conversations. They see us as cost money, right? We don't make widgets. We're not producing sales. We're not bringing in revenue. But we also have, I call it, look at your ROI through your human resources. What's your turnover? What's your retention? What's your cost to hire? All of those things have a financial impact to the organization. And I always tell other HR managers that I coach or VPs, I'll say, make it make sense to the CEO. Make it make sense and put it in numbers. So if you break down and say, we just saved 6% on our insurance premium, break it down so it makes sense in numbers. Oh, that's a $500,000 savings to our bottom line. Make that make sense, because they don't see it as we're bringing in revenue. They see it as payroll. It's mostly your hugest expense on your balance sheet. So I always tell the executives, learn the financial piece of it as well. Learn to talk the financial piece. Learn to read when the CFO is giving you the financial statements, and you need to understand your budget. Understand when they're going over the financials and operations. You understand it. So I even encourage our HR managers, people that I mentor, to take financial courses so that they understand the financial impact that HR has on an organization, and then break that financial impact down and take it to the CEO and have those conversations and say, this is the impact, positively or negatively, that the HR is making on the organization.
It's wonderful advice, and I couldn't agree more. The shift I went through when I got that financial learning and was able to put things into numbers really made making those arguments to the leadership team or those investment decisions more effective. It's one of the reasons I always point to Gallup for engagement surveys, because they have such great metrics. And it was so fantastic when we were able to show over a number of years, as we increased engagement using Gallup's engagement survey, the financial increases, the double-digit profitability growth, the double-digit productivity improvements that we experienced, because it correlated directly to levels of engagement. And we knew that from Gallup's years and years of research. And that just made such a difference in a decision to invest in certain things, because now you could really see, okay, no, really there's science behind this. There's metrics behind this impact. And I think for a while now, metrics like you mentioned, like retention and turnover and the cost to rehire and those types of things, we've talked about those. Those are what I like to think of as like the hard costs, because you're going to have to expend that money to replace those positions. But then there's also this whole side of the performance costs, or the opportunity loss that you're getting when you have employees who are actively disengaged, quiet quitting, working against your interests, purposefully not putting in full effort, or not developed or grown enough to even be able to give their full capacity or be able to contribute as much as they might be able to do. So there's a lot of, I think, untapped potential in there as well, when we look at people as simply a number, another tool or another thing, rather than the organic, interesting, complex human living being that humans really are in terms of what they can bring and what they can deliver. They're not just another widget, like you said. They have a greater value, actually, because a widget can't be changed, but a person can actually be able to bring and contribute more. So I love that you brought that up and brought that kind of context of understanding kind of that financial investment and what it takes to make those arguments, to be at that strategic level as a people leader. And I'm confident that's the role you're playing now in the space that you're in now. What, as a strategic HR leader, as a C-suite leader, are you really focused on in your organization? What is it that you're seeing as really important and strategic for a C-suite HR leader to be addressing in the workplace?
That's a really good question. And as the YWCA being a nonprofit, we don't make anything. We rely on grants. We rely on the government to fund. And a lot of times when we receive grants, it's very specific on why we need to use that money. So we can't go, oh, we're going to take this money, go use it over here. So what we do is from a C-suite, I'm saying to the rest of the C-suite that we focus on the people development, professional development, training and development. Those are all three things that have a significant impact to the organization. The employees see that we're investing money and resources and time into them to say we value you as an organization. So that is something that we as the YWCA, I'm proud to say, we do that well in developing our staff, in developing trainings. And there are your normal trainings that you have to do, corporate training that we give to everyone. But then we work closely with the actual hiring manager and say, what in particular does that one individual need? Because one size does not fit all. You may take a person and say, okay, you need this specific training. And then how do we get it? How do we measure it? And then let's continue with it. Because oftentimes it's not just one training. You have to continue to invest in your team. So from a C-suite, one of my 2024 goals, I actually had a presentation to the board of directors a couple of weeks ago, and I said, I'm going to really put the people first. That is going to be the first line. It's really focusing on the people of the organization. And the reason is because we do hear a feedback from, I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know I was supposed to do that. Or I'd like to go over here and learn about how to become this position. What does it take for me to take this position? So we really want to focus on what works for our staff. What works for, I'll give you an example, we have a new administrative assistant. And I sat down with her and I said, what are your goals? If her goal is to stay as administrative assistant, that's okay. But guess what? Be the best administrative assistant. But that also means you may have to take additional courses, additional training to make you the best administrative assistant. We also have some people to say, this is my first job, but I want to know where can I progress in the organization. And we say, we're willing to invest in you, but you also have to step forward and say, these are the things that I have to do as well. So it's a lot of communication, a lot of transparency, a lot of dialogue that we have with our staff from the C-suite on down to our administrators, to our managers. That is an expectation that we push down to our staff and they really appreciate it. We have town hall meetings where we are just 100% transparent. We all come together. We get outside of the office, we go off site, we have a great time, and we talk about what's going on in the organization from a financial standpoint to an operations standpoint to a human resources standpoint. So they get a chance to hear from all of the C-suite on what's going on, and that really goes over well. But I think focusing on the people really strategically from my position saying, let's dive deep into the people. And because I see what's going on from an HR standpoint, I hear a lot. I see a lot from a person, people, a standpoint. And there are definitely some initiatives we can improve in, which is the professional development side of our staff.
So a couple questions come to mind there. One is I'm curious a little bit about how do people generally react to that? Are people wanting that development, that training, those opportunities? And how do you guys handle their doing that? Is that something that they are expected to do kind of on top of their job? Is that baked into their daily workday? Or how do you navigate, one, do they want to do it? And then two, if they do, how does that fit into what they're, the work that they're doing or that you need them to do to begin with?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. You have some staff that don't want to. you have staff that, you know, hey, Sharon, I want to be this, and that's okay. What we still expect you to do is to perform, and we evaluate you, do your reviews and things like that. But we also have a team, and I'm really finding this out with our new Gen Z millennials. They want to come in because in their mind, they only want to be in a position for a year. They're ready to say, if I don't see a career path for myself, I'm not staying. So we talk about our oldest person in the organization is 79. Our youngest is 21. So we have, but our average age is 45. So with that, we have a span of 21, 45, and 79. And in between, we've got 60 and 50-year-olds. What we find, it's our younger generation that says, what's in it for me? Where do I go after my year? Where do I go after 2 years? And I actually love those conversations. From an HR standpoint, it's not something that I can always answer, but it's something I have to reach out to their manager and say, hey, you've got an aggressive staff member who is bringing value to the organization. They've been here for a year, but they want to know what's their career path. Let's set something. What I don't want is an overpromise to say, oh, in the next 2 years, you're going to be this and this, because it takes a process on how we get there. Sometimes it may be you need to go back to school, or you need to go to school, because some positions require a degree. And if you don't have a degree, that is a conversation we will have and say, hey, we would love to have you in that position, but it requires a degree. What are your thoughts on that? And then some will say, I'm not ready to go back to school. And guess what? That's okay. So then for that position, it's not going to be something that we can go, we're going to automatically move you into. But what other options do we have for you? Because the whole point is we want to retain our staff. We really want to focus on not turnover. Turnover to me is point of no return. They already left. You're having a conversation on exit interview. So we want to know. And one of the things we do is we do stay interviews. So with our new employees at 90 days, we do what's called a stay interview. What brought you to the YWCA? And then tell other people about us. And then the 6 months, we do a 6 month review. What's changed from your 90 days to your 6 months? Have you grown? Have you learned? Are there some areas that you still need to be trained on? When we get to that year annual review, that's the key. You've stayed with us for a year. Your review was good. We want to continue for another year, and let's work on a path. But that is a group of people or staff that are very verbal about it. Hey, I'm ready to move up. Clap for you. I'm excited for you. And then we have a staff that just say, you know what, Sharon, I like where I am, and I don't have a desire, let's say, to manage people. But what we also do is not just do stay interviews with our new staff. We do stay interviews with our staff that's been here for many years. And we say to them, why do you stay here? What are we doing as an organization? What can we do better? And then we also will partner them with the new team. Because a lot of times our new staff, they don't understand it takes a while to learn our organization. We're a complicated organization. So what we'll do is we'll partner them with someone in the organization in that department to say, hey, you're on the right track, but it takes time to learn the organization. Communications is huge, and transparency. My door is always open. Anybody can always call me. I'll always answer the phone, and we find that works well for our organization.
So I'm curious, shifting gears a little bit, what have been or what do you see as some of your biggest challenges right now? What are some of the things that you're really dealing with or have been dealing with for the last 6 months, or you see yourself dealing with in the coming 6 months that are a focus for you?
Couple of challenges that we have been talking about for quite a bit is staffing, and that's with so many organizations. We are fighting against a workforce. There's so many positions out there, and for some reason, people either are not coming into the workplace, or they're choosing to do the quick dollar. Someone may say, I don't want to be in the office 8 hours a day. Our positions as a teacher requires you to be in the classroom. So you can't be, on Zoom teaching a student. So we're up against some of the other organizations where they have a hybrid schedule where someone really works 100% remote. We don't necessarily have that availability right now. It's a topic that we're constantly talking about to see, is that such a big challenge in our staffing that we're going to have to shift somewhere and maybe make that a possibility? I'll give you an example. We had a young lady who worked hybrid at a previous employer, and she worked 3 days a week at her previous employer at home and 2 days in the office. So when we interviewed, we said, this is 100% in the office. Are you okay with that? Was very clear about it. She stayed with us for 1 month and said, I can't do it. I can't do the 100% in the office. I need a hybrid. And that position is not available for hybrid. So unfortunately, that did not work out. So we know we're dealing with, she thought she could do it. She said, mentally, physically, I just can't do it. So we're finding really a lot post-COVID, a lot of things change with our staffing strategy. The industry we're in with teachers is such a shortage. People are not going into the teaching industry. So we're fighting against an industry that a lot of people are not going into. Child care, as we talked about, is a huge problem in the United States. And it's a conversation that the administration is constantly talking about. Our local leaders are talking about, and no one has an answer. Nobody has an answer to it. So we're all trying to figure out what can work best for our organization. That is a huge struggle for us. The other thing is just dealing with a 3.8% unemployment, which is very low. It's very low. And we're all seem to be fighting for the same pool of candidates. Oftentimes, the candidates that we find that we get, we don't necessarily, it's not the candidates we would really want to hire. So do you say somebody's better than no one? No, we rather focus on quality and not just have someone come in and say, I need a job. What we do as an organization, we focus on bringing services that are outstanding to our Head Start program and to our sexual assault domestic violence program. So we don't want someone who's just to come in and say, I just need a job and I'm just going to. No, we rather focus on quality and have you here for the mission of the nonprofit and being able to service the children in our Head Start and our women in our sexual assault domestic violence. So there were positions we just decided not to fill. We had 65 openings at one given time. We knew we could not fill them. We had a plan B and outsource some of those positions to other partners. And then we decided just not to be able to fill those positions. So we're now down to 35 positions, which is durable for our organization.
35 open positions mm-hmm. that you're trying to fill. Yes. And would you say most of your positions are because of them being teachers or having to work in the crisis domestic violence assault segment are require that in-person element versus hybrid?
Yes. And in those, and on the sexual assault domestic violence side, there is easy burnout. Because what you're dealing with are therapists, case managers, what's called intervention advocates. All they're hearing is what we call bad news. Someone has been sexually assaulted. Someone has been domestic violence. Someone is sex trafficked. Someone's running from their abuser. And our team, we only allow them to see so many cases. And we also only allow them to go out, let's say, to the hospital and meet with the client one or two a day, because otherwise it's too much. And then they have to come in and do what's called a detox, where they'll come in and talk with a counselor to say, you know what, this was a bad day because I just met with a client who was extremely violated, and you're human. You're dealing with the human side. So you too have to take a step back and say, so what we have to do is also put measures in place so there's not burnout for that team. On the other side with our teachers, again, it's just purely a shortage of staffing, that nobody no longer wants to be a teacher. Nobody wants to be a fireman anymore. They want STEAM. They want the technology. They want the Google. They want the science, technology, engineering, math, not so much the teaching aspect. And we really need teachers, because we're instilling and we're taking our 6 weeks to 4 years and we're preparing them for the rest of the world. So we're preparing them for what's to come when you get into kindergarten and then you go into middle school and things like that. So our teachers play such an important role in those children. We can accept up to 1,229 students in our program. Because of our teaching shortage, we've not been able to accommodate that number of students. So where do they go? Because the parents have to work. They have to go somewhere. And that's been the struggle with childcare since the COVID pandemic.
Yeah. And you and I talked about this, that there's just, it doesn't matter where you look, there's just this shortage of resources when it comes to childcare. And that those early years for kids, as you learn about or understand brain development and what happens in those first 4 years, is a tremendous amount of brain growth, of neural connections that form in a child's brain. And so that early support can make a huge difference for the long-term success of children, their long-term development, and both psychological, social, and intellectually, what they're capable of doing. And so it's just so important to have teachers in that space. And likewise, where my girls go, they're 4 years old, and they struggle to keep people and teachers in those positions. And it's continued to be a really big challenge. And I'm not sure as a society, we've got a real good answer for how to create more interest in a profession that we really haven't invested in a lot from a financial standpoint. We haven't placed value on that this teaching is actually really important to us. We place more value on the products and the things that we purchase and we get than we do necessarily on teachers. And so I can see how that, especially as a non-for-profit, is even more challenging to find those folks and to keep. What are some of the strategies you're taking in order to try to overcome that hurdle or that challenge?
So what we actually implement, because we knew that was a struggle pre-pandemic, but it's worse post-pandemic. So what we've done, we've implemented sign-on bonuses. We took a look at our critical positions in the organization and we said, this is where the biggest impact. When one teacher leaves, it changes the whole dynamics of one classroom. We may sometimes even have to say, oh, we don't have enough staff. We can't open that classroom. So what we did was we have sign-on bonuses for our hard-to-fill position with our teachers. We also do what's called a teacher contract. So what they did is if they stay with us, they would get a bonus or amount. And then we switched that to now we switch it over to a retention bonus. So the longer you stay with us, the more you get. The longer you stay as a teacher, and we pay it out on a quarterly basis, that we're saying thank you. We appreciate you staying with us, retaining your appointment with us as a teacher and a teacher assistant. And here is something to say thank you for. And we actually give them a quarterly bonus for doing that. We just implemented that actually a few months ago. And it's going over well. We've seen very little teachers leave. We had two teachers leave. And sometimes it takes a teacher to leave and then they come back. So we actually had two teachers leave. And I said, okay, I hate to see them go. But they came back. And I said, why did you come back? Because we welcomed them back. And they said, you know what, Sharon? I thought the grass was greener on the other side, and it wasn't. And they said, you know what? I miss the kids. The YMC is a great organization. We have a great Head Start program, and I want to come back. And I said, and we talked to them before rehiring them back. And we said, okay, why are you coming back? and they were honest. We talked about open and honest communication. And with that, they were able to say, Sharon, these are some things that we can do differently. And I was like, let's pass that information on. And so now we welcome them back. They started on Monday. And these were two long-term employees, like 15 years. And then they just thought, I want to see what else is out there. I've been with the Y 15 years. What else is out there? And if they went, found out, it's actually not better. And they came back. So I'm excited about that. We did lose a couple of teachers because of the vaccine. Once we were able to lift the vaccine through the Biden administration and that pandemic is over, we reached out to those teachers and four of them came back. So that is our strategy with our hard to fill positions. Also, we increased our employee referral. When I first started with the organization, our employee referral, we were given $50. And I said, no one's going to refer anyone for $50. And you were taxed on it. So I went to our CFO, who's the newest CFO, and she understands, again, the strategic piece of it, of the impact of someone leaving. So I proposed, I put it in numbers, said, hey, Kim, how about increasing our referral bonus to 500? And we pay and we gross it up. And she said, let's do it. And I thought, you get it. You understand the impact. So what took place? Our employer referrals have gone up because our employer payout went from 50 to 500. So we would have one a year. Now we have probably 10. And then we'll ask those 10 people, do you know someone? And then we'll ask those 10 people, do you know someone? So it's a so on and so on. So that was just a strategy that we changed from a financial impact. But even though we raised it from 50 to 500, the ROI of getting those positions filled is much longer. It's a greater return on our investment just by increasing our employee referral.
I think that's a really powerful motivator for folks, and even more so a testament to that they want to refer people, that they believe in what you're doing and the purpose and the mission that you guys are serving and the gap that you're filling in the community in terms of the services that you provide. I want to go back to you talked about somebody who made the decision that she couldn't do full time in the office and yes, needed that hybrid. When you see those scenarios, what do you think, or have you noticed what's driving it? Is it circumstance? Is it psychological? What is it that's driving that decision to say, I can't work full time in an office or in a classroom setting?
I think it's a combination of both. When COVID hit in 2019, it hit December 2019, 2020 was the worst year. Everything was shut down. Buildings were shut down. 2021, we were still in it. 2 years, 2022. So people got used to doing this for 3 years. So having to come back into something that you've not had to do for 3 years, people have already made up their mind, I just don't want to do it. I don't want to work in the office 5 days a week. And I'm not going to work in the office 5 days. And then here's the thing, people have choice. So with unemployment 3.8%, guess what? They will go find a job that can accommodate that. And that's what we're finding is, from a strategic standpoint, I'm going back to our C-suite and say, all possibilities are now on the table. Hybrid has to be a conversation that is now impacting our ability to staff positions. We must now take a look at the possibility of making it work versus why it can't work. So I'm shifting our thought process to say, oh, it can't work. No, and one of the things we're doing is our CFO, she's responsible for our technology. So our IT falls up under her. She recognizes that we needed to enhance our IT. If you are working from home, we have what's called a work from home policy. And that is one here. If you need not take a PTO, but you're exempt and you need to just work from home for that day, that's fine. But it's not a permanent work from home. But what we had to do was shift and enhance our IT. Our technology was not up to speed. It was, you would get home, you're like, I can't even log in. I can't. You know, so we found on the opposite side, it wasn't productive. And we had challenges. So people are like, I'll just come into the office. bringing that to our CFO, she recognizes we have an issue with our IT. What do we need to do? We're in the process. We've upgraded a lot of things, which I'm glad to see. But now also, now that we're creating a better IT platform, let's also say how this can work. Let's take this. Let's take a look at hybrid. I've positioned it to our CEO and our C-suite. And it's more of a make it make sense. It's going to make sense if we have a better workforce that we can do a hybrid. We will get more staff. We'll get higher quality staff. And we'll see the impact of a simple best practice that many organizations already have in place. And many organizations are doing it right. And it's working. I talk to a lot of HR, my HR peers, and probably out of 10 people that I've talked to, 9 of them have a hybrid. So we're operating, we're not in the norm right now as far as not having a hybrid schedule. We're operating in old best practice. So it's going to leave us behind a little bit if we don't adopt and say how this can actually work. Doing study, doing research, most organizations are 1 or 2 days, you can come into the office, and the rest you're working from home.
So how do you do that? I'm just curious, as you are exploring that, how do you do that with your teachers or your folks that are handling those crisis type situations? How do you create a hybrid that works for those scenarios?
For certain positions, we can't. So we know there are certain positions. So I took a look at all of our positions in the organization, and I put a check by those positions that we could do a hybrid: HR, accounting, marketing. There are days where I'm here and I'm thinking, I don't even know what I did today because a lot of things took place. And I thought to myself, I need to get out of the office. I need to either work from home 1 or 2 days to get the higher level things done that I need to do. But when I find I'm in the office 5 days a week, I'm having a little bit of a challenge getting that done as much because of meetings or conversations that come in throughout the day. So I've already identified the positions that we can do a hybrid. Again, my motto is make it make sense and the ROI behind them if we change this best practice. So that's where I'm now having the conversations with our C-suite to say there are some positions that can definitely be hybrid. And let's look and see how we can make that work.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, too, if at some point, I don't know if now is the time, but if at some point there is a breaking point where it's actually more cost effective to hire somebody to be a teacher 30 hours a week in person or 25 hours a week in person, and you have to hire more people to cover to cover the different time periods. So maybe you have 2 teachers per classroom splitting the day or something like that. And they maybe get paid as much as they maybe used to get paid, but they don't have to work as many hours so that they can have that flexibility or that shifted schedule. And I wonder too, at what point that we get there, right? Where there's enough financial investment and enough need to say, hey, you know what? We could probably, this might be more financially beneficial because we can serve more people. And not just in the teaching space. I wonder that too, in the medical and nursing space where there's such a shortage there as well. How do you get to that point where you have to really rethink how it's even structured to make it possible?
When the international company that I worked for 7 years, it was everyone, the culture was teamwork, collaboration. We served very high-end clients. So with that, it was a lot of work that went into serving a high-end client. Our CEO saw that we were working, and he said, we're going to try this out for the summer. We're going to shut down at noon in the summer months, Memorial Day to Labor Day. We'll shut down at noon and everybody go home. Whoa, that is fantastic. And we did that. And it went over so well. Then he saw people were saying, I'm so busy. It's going to work until 5. He said, no, because what we were seeing was burnout. We were seeing stress go up. we saw, I was giving him data. I was saying more people are going out in FMLA, more people are using EAP. Something is going on. Presenting that information to him, he said, Sharon, would it work if we paid everyone for 40 hours a week, but at noon we shut down? And I said, let's try it. If it doesn't work, we'll go back to the old way. So we only did it for the summer months. It went over so well, we did it for the time. It became a permanent best practice. So not just for the summer, for the whole year, you were paid for 40 hours and you got to leave at noon. And there was a couple of stragglers, but the culture was, and the CEO's communication was, I value you. I know you guys work more than 40 hours and I want you to go home at noon o'clock and do what you need to do for the rest of the afternoon. So when people were still there, it was, oh, you're still here. You better leave. You don't want to get a phone call. Because a lot of times people got a chance to get their oil changed. They got a chance to make doctor's appointments for their kids. They got the 4-hour difference, or 5-hour difference was significant for a lot of our staff. And they were like, gosh, I didn't have to use my PTO to go get my oil changed. I didn't have to go use PTO to go to make my doctor's appointment. So that was when we did that. We also did a survey to say, how did you guys like it? And it went over so well in the positive feedback, we said, let's just continue to do it.
I love it.
It was one of the best practices we put in place at that organization where the staff morale went way up and appreciation went way up because they felt like, you guys are listening. We're tired.
Yeah.
We're tired. And we really appreciate you doing this.
But I think it's such a great example of getting creative with other ways. And I find when talking to different people and understanding what different organizations are going through, I think that the childcare challenge is also impacting the hiring challenge, that the folks that would typically fill some of those positions have their own childcare challenges that create complexity. And I know my husband and I, we both have the opportunity to work remotely. And thankfully, because our son didn't, we had signed him up for aftercare and he couldn't get, there was a wait list for aftercare. There wasn't enough in the public school system, enough people to cover the aftercare programs. He rides the bus home. He gets home in the afternoon because we're here. It's not a big deal that he gets home. We finish our workday. But if that weren't the case, it would be very difficult to be in an office and have our 7-year-old son getting home to an empty house because there's no one there. And I know that's what I think a lot of parents are having to struggle with and having to figure out and navigate in a world that's changed post-COVID. And I think you've done a great job here of highlighting that challenge and the challenge of even filling the positions to make childcare more available and how difficult that is. So Sharon, I appreciate so much all of the insights and the wisdom and the experience that you've shared with us. I want to give you a chance to give us any final thoughts that you have for our audience as we're wrapping this episode up with all these like great nuggets of wisdom and things that you've experienced in your career. What do you have or what would you like to leave with our audience?
Jessica, I really appreciate this conversation. I really enjoyed it. I would like to leave with your listeners, we're in this together. Not one person can do it by themselves. We need everyone's input. May not be the best input, may not be the input we need, but we need all voices to speak up to say, this is what's going on in the United States. This is what's going on in staffing, in childcare, and we need answers. We need support. We need help. We need assistance. So I would say be the voice that you need to be so that we can collaboratively get out of this situation. There's a solution to this problem, but absolutely, we need everybody's help to do it.
I love that, Sharon. And I think you're absolutely right. And it's going to take a level of creativity to come up with how do we navigate this challenge? How do we find solutions that create a win outcome for everybody who's impacted and navigating these challenges? So I can't express enough how much we appreciate the work that the YWCA does and that you do in trying to staff such a mission called purpose and such that brings such tremendous value to the community. So thank you for what you do. Thank you for the service that you and your organization provide. It is just so important and so valuable. And I can't express enough gratitude for the work that you guys are doing and the mission that you're serving. And I want to, as we wrap up this episode, just remind our listeners to always keep evolving, always keep growing, keep looking for those opportunities to rewire your neural pathways so that you can have more exceptional experiences on your life journey, so that you can find those opportunities to really enjoy your life in ways that you might not otherwise. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day, and we'll be back again next week with another episode.